Inside Chicago Government. ShyGov.com.
Welcome to another in a series of interviews with Ben Jarofsky. I'm Dave Gloetz. Ben writes on government and politics for the Chicago Reader, and he's here with me today. Welcome to the broadcast.
Thank you, Senator.
Today, we're talking about Chicago Public Schools, or CPS.
CPS.
And the first day of public school in Chicago was September 8th. When school starts, do you start getting more contact from teachers and parents and school administrators?
It doesn't so much connect literally to the school calendar as it connects to a particular school policy. So if the policy is announced in May, that's when I get the call. If the policy is announced in June.
So something that erupts in
yes,
the public eye.
Or is about to erupt. Like, for instance, right now, I'm getting contacted about a proposal to unite two schools on the north side, Ogden and Jenner, which sounds like an interesting proposal. So it's when things happen, people call me and go, you should write about this.
And we're coming up, I think, next week on the count of classrooms, right? So CPS can determine how many students are in each school, and that's the figures on which they base the per-pupil funding.
Right. I give you a lot of credit for knowing that. Yeah.
I just remember it's the 20th.
20 right? days in, and that does not account weekends, so it's 20 school days.
20 days from the 8th.
That is correct, Senator.
So it's probably maybe the beginning of October.
Yeah, right? And everything is iffy this year because the school board's budget is contingent on money from Springfield that Springfield has not said they're going to send to them. And, of course, there's an impasse in Springfield. So this could be a hard school year to predict in terms of deadlines.
So you're talking about this fantasy that the school board engaged in this past budget cycle where they included $480 million
yes.
that they are hoping to get as state aid, but there's no such
yes,
state aid currently
correct.
Available.
Well, I would argue that every year the budget is nothing more than a fantasy. It's a projection, of course. But yes, in this particular case, it's even more fantastical than normal, I suppose. So I don't know how that's going to affect the 20-day formula is what I'm getting at. I don't know. It could be more drastic. I mean, if there's no money coming in from the state to fortify the budget, maybe everybody's going to get cuts, whether they have more kids or not. Schools that had increases in enrollment will not get more money. By the way, I think the 20-day deadline is utterly absurd and works against the best interests of children, which is what they're supposed to be looking out for.
Why?
Well, because it builds chaos into the system. It's already a chaotic system as it is. Any public school system is. But in this case, a principal is required after the start of the school year to completely reschedule classes, move teachers around, move kids around. So any sense of continuity is destroyed.
You're saying that after they make the count, then they make adjustments based on what that says about the money they're going to get?
Yeah, what happens is this. The board gives an allowance to a school based on the number of children in the school, and the principal then appropriates that money with teacher salaries primarily.
Let me stop you there. Before school starts, the principals already have done this, if I'm not mistaken, based on an estimate.
That is correct.
That CPS has done before this 20-day
yes.
count.
Yes.
So there's an initial take.
Yes. So there's the estimate. So there's projection. Let's say, just for the sake of this discussion, they have a projected enrollment that would allow them to have 10 teachers. After 20 days, they may say, oh my God, the enrollment's not as high as we thought. We're taking away a teacher. Well, if you take away a teacher, there's a ripple effect. You have to suddenly rearrange your schedule. You have to move kids from algebra class A to algebra class B.
Because those kids got to go somewhere.
Yes. There's always like a breakdown when this happens while they figure it out. So there's time, like days when kids aren't in any class or just sitting in the auditorium.
So it really disrupts the
yeah, it's very disruptive.
Of the school
year. If, as I say, the education of children was your primary objective and point, you would never allow this. You would get rid of this crazy 20-day period. But, of course, this is not the primary objective.
And was the 20-day count implemented as a result of per-pupil funding?
No. The 20-day count has been around for a long time. I don't know the history of it when it was implemented, but it predates what Rahm did when he changed the allowance. See, in the old days, before Rahm, schools were awarded a certain number of teachers based on enrollment. And so whatever the teacher cost was covered. So the principal could hire a veteran teacher with a lot of experience who would be at the top pay scale. Now the schools are awarded a per pupil allowance. So there's an incentive against hiring more expensive teachers, veteran teachers who are at the top of the pay scale. That's a change that Mayor Rahm made.
But going back to the effect of the count, if before they were doing per pupil funding, they were doing the amount of pupils governing the number of teachers that they had.
Yes.
Wouldn't that also have caused chaos?
Yes, I argued against. I've been arguing. This is one of the many points that I've been on the losing side of for years, going back to, I think, the 90s. These are the days when the people at the Board of Ed actually talked to me. They would say things like, well, Ben, we've always done it this way. You know, like, that justifies it. But anyways, I thought it was madness then.
How do other districts do it?
They don't do it this way. Like, for instance, real school districts like New Trier or Evanston.
They have to have some kind of number of students to base their budget on.
Yeah,
right?
Well, you just do it at the end of the year.
And then use that for the following
year. Yeah, that's it. Why would you abort mission? You know what I mean? Only Chicago would do it this way.
I'm going to come back to budgeting in a minute. But first, I want to talk about one of those events that erupted that we were alluding to.
Okay.
That happened recently concerning Diet High School.
Oh, okay.
Diet is on the south side at the north end of Washington Park on 51st Street. And you wrote about it in an August 28th blog post titled, Mayor Rahm to Diet Activists, No Free Choice for You.
Oh, okay. I remember that.
What happened here is the CPS administration decided in 2012 to close Diet, but CPS rescinded that decision this year when it requested proposals from interested parties as to how the school might be reconstituted. CPS got three proposals, and one was from activists involved in the Kenwood Oakland Community Organization, known as COCO. These activists have been agitating since 2012 to keep Diet open as a neighborhood school. And over a dozen Diet supporters began a hunger strike on August 17th, and they were striking to compel Mayor Rahm Emanuel and CPS to commit to the COCO activist proposal, and the activists want an open enrollment school. Then on September 3rd, the day after Diet activists shut down the mayor's public budget hearing on the south side.
Yeah, I was there that night.
CPS announced that it would not choose any of the three proposals, but would reopen Diet as, quote, a new open enrollment, arts-focused neighborhood high school and community innovation lab, end quote. So I got a couple questions about this. First one is, the COCO-affiliated hunger strikers say that they were blindsided by the city's announcement to create this current version, and they say that they'll continue their hunger strike till the mayor and CPS agree, among other things, to involve COCO in the constitution and operation of the school. Others say that the activists should accept the city's plan because it gives them pretty much what they wanted, namely an open enrollment school at Diet.
Who are the others?
You can read, for example, Mary Mitchell in the Sun-Times. She came out and said, I've heard that opinion echoed.
I hear it a lot.
Yeah.
Virtually every day I hear that opinion. What's with those Diet people?
Yeah, which prompts still others to say that the administration made a really clever move, because it puts that kind of pressure on COCO to just like take its toys and go home, you know, to claim victory. But at the same time, it prevents COCO from having any real input into the new school. So what do you think about this?
Primarily, this is an extension of a very bitter local feud between the activists from COCO and the local alderman in that area, a man named Will Burns.
Which you wrote about.
Yes. There's no love lost, to put it mildly, between COCO and Will Burns. And Will Burns is also a very close ally of Mayor Emanuel. In fact, the mayor named Alderman Burns to be the chair of the education committee, which is kind of funny that the mayor gets to name who heads the council's committees. But until that feud is settled, COCO will not be allowed to have anything to do with this school. It was COCO's pressure that forced Mayor Emanuel to ultimately agree to give a school to Diet or to reopen Diet. But I don't believe he'll ever set up a situation where COCO has some sort of say in how that school is run.
And when the announcement happened, I thought that was pretty brilliant on the part of the administration.
Well, you know, I'm always looking for ways to give the mayor credit.
I mean, it was politically brilliant.
I think the really politically brilliant would to invite COCO to the press conference.
That presumes they would have bought in beforehand.
I can't speak for COCO, that's for certain. But had they been invited to the press conference, I think they would have appeared. But I don't know, maybe not. The point is that COCO forced the mayor to make good on his promise to reopen the school. And then once he reopened it, give him credit, I suppose. He made it clear that Coco was going to have nothing to do with it. So I guess the analogy, now that I'm sitting here thinking about it, Dave, would be like in the old days when old man Mayor Daley would be forced to enact some good government legislation that, say, Leon Dupre, who was an independent alderman, was proposing. So instead of allowing Leon Dupre's proposal to be adopted by the city council, he would take the idea, rework it, have one of his allies introduce it, and then it would be unanimously approved. But the exercise was set up to let Leon Dupre and every other independent know that he or she can't tell the boss how to run the system.
This is in control.
Yeah. So to me, this is similar. And the argument for Coco would be like Leon Dupre and accept the fact that the good thing was done, even though you're never going to get credit for it. And Coco's argument right back is, unless we're part of the process right now, we don't trust the city to make good on its promise or its pledge.
And a minute ago, you suggested that one resolution might be some shuttle diplomacy between Coco and Alderman Burns.
The likelihood of that happening is about as likely as Mayor Rahm appointing me to his infrastructure fund board, which means it's not going to happen and that I could predict. This is a bitter feud. Mm. I think the line I use in the story is they're like the Hatfield and McCoys. They've been fighting for a long time.
Just one more thing on this. We keep talking about this term open enrollment, and it's an interesting term. What does it mean? According to CPS, it means two things. One, that students who live within a school's attendance boundary don't have to apply to the school to attend. They can just essentially show up. And secondly, if there's room, you know, if the school doesn't fill up with local kids, kids out of the attendance area can apply and they'll be randomly accepted for the available spaces through a lottery. So on paper, at least, this gives preference to the local kids. So I looked at the CPS website and I have here a map of the attendance boundary for Diet School. And it's roughly a shape of an S, with the top of the S at like 41st Street going all the way to the lakefront.
Yeah.
The bottom of the S is down here somewhere around 60th, butting up against the Dan Ryan Expressway. And listeners, if you'd like to see this attendance area map, you could go to shygov.com and look at the description of this interview. The only other high school in this attendance boundary is King, which is a selective enrollment school, which means
correct.
That to get in there,
you have to take a test.
Yeah, you take an exam, and it's available to kids citywide. This says to me it's pretty significant that CPS kept Diet open, since that's the only open enrollment high school in that attendance area.
And I give Coco credit for this. It's significant in that it's a reversal of CPS policy for this area for the last 10 years, which is to largely to saturate the area with charter schools, which divert students from the unionized schools as part of an overall effort, in my humble opinion, to undercut the power of the Chicago Teachers Union under the guise of choice.
In fact, on this map, we can see them surrounded by them.
In fact, one of the proposals that was a rival proposal to Coco's was for a contract school, Little Black Pearl, to move in there. Contract school is not a unionized school. So I would say that's the larger victory, if you will, and this is a topic I'm probably going to be exploring later. I've been thinking about a lot is how there is a trend in the city that I've noticed against charter schools, so maybe like a delayed backlash. It's particularly strong on the north side. We may have talked about this before. I think north side is pretty much off limits for charter schools, so they're limited now to the south side and the southwest side. And what we see in this Diet fight is that they're not that popular on the south side either. There was the greatest outcry was for a public school. Ultimately, Rahm decided not to bring Coco into the public school that he's going to open. You know, they're his political enemies. But I think that this is a triumph for the public school movement, if you want to call it that, that the mayor is retreating from this charter school expansion.
Chalk that one up. Let's talk now, Ben, about CPS's budget crisis, which seems to be an annual event.
Yeah.
The drama in this year's crisis, though, is rather high.
Yeah.
With CPS continuing to borrow many millions of dollars, and including, as we said earlier, in its 2015 budget, the $500 million in state aid that doesn't currently exist. And adding to the sort of comedy here is the recent revelation by our intrepid newspaper colleagues that in the last 2 months, CPS staffers have spent $500,000 ordering food out from restaurants.
This is my beloved Sun Times, Lauren Fitzpatrick, another big scoop.
Yeah, so maybe it's Claypool's heavy hitters that he just brought in. They need a lot of sustenance.
Yeah, I don't know. Claypool immediately blamed it on the predecessor. That didn't happen under us. Hey, man, everybody's got to eat.
So you and I talked in the past about CPS and the regime in the late 90s.
Mm-hmm.
Namely, it was run by Superintendent Paul Vallis and Board of Education President Gary Chico.
Yes.
And you've criticized Vallis and Chico for balancing the CPS budget at the expense of contributions to teacher pension funds. Is that accurate?
Yes.
Well, Vallis has defended himself.
Yes, I saw
that. You saw that in a letter to the Chicago Tribune on August 25th, 2015. He wrote, quote, "In 1996, I made a promise in writing to the Chicago Teachers Union that Chicago public schools would increase pension contributions the moment funding levels dropped below an actuarially approved threshold.
Mm-hmm.
If that promise was broken, it was broken after 2001 when I left CPS with a fully funded pension system and $1.2 billion in cash reserves." And Vallis went on to write, "CPS had structural budget problems for decades. Between 1995 and 2001, fixing that was my job, together with the board led by President Gary Chico. Because we closed a projected five-year $1 billion deficit by structurally balancing the budget, we elevated CPS out of junk bond status by winning 12 bond upgrades from the credit agencies." And lastly, Vallis writes, "Chico and I implemented a five-year fiscal plan with strict rules, such as not creating overcapacity, limiting borrowing, refusing to borrow for operating costs as opposed to capital projects, and keeping pensions fully funded. Between 1995, stick with me, we're almost done.
Okay.
Between 1995 and 2001, we lived within our means and met our obligations while carefully managing the budget to send every possible dollar to the classroom." As Amy Goodman would say, your response.
Well, first of all, just so our listeners know, that is a letter to the editor of the Chicago Tribune, not the Chicago Reader. I know you said that, but I just want to reaffirm that. And he was responding in particular, this is why I'm affirming this, to a front page story that ran in the Tribune, which I was astounded to read, and I applaud them for running it, which talked about how the 1995 school reform law was actually at the root of our current fiscal crisis.
He was rebutting that.
Yeah. So if you wait long enough, the Tribune will start saying the same things I'm saying. I'm waiting for them to turn against Rauner. Look, Paul Vallis was fortunate that he was presiding over the Chicago Public Schools at a time of economic growth, particularly in the property tax base, and a boom time that preceded a fall. So he had an influx of funds that his successors did not have. So to a certain degree, Arne had it too. Arne Duncan, who immediately followed him. Since about 07, they've been in a crisis stage. So in terms of teacher pensions, you can contribute less money to the pension fund, but see more growth because the economy is growing stronger, which enables you to sustain your threshold of money that you have to have in there, even as the economy is slowly tanking.
So his argument that under his stewardship that the pension funds were adequately funded, you're saying, is not so much a function of his good fiscal policy, but taking advantage of the financial climate.
Good fortune, luck, timing. I would appreciate it if our leaders were honest, but of course they can't be. But in other words, to me, the honest, politically incorrect responses, you know, you dummies in Chicago are so foolish, you think we can run this government without taxing it. So I took advantage of the money. I just took what money was flowing in, spent it for whatever our immediate needs were, used it to fix up schools, which won you over, got you happy. And now, finally, you're paying the bill for it. Well, if you were realistic and you weren't such, you know, silly fools, I could have taxed you to the full extent that we need to fund government. But I can't because you believe that government can run without money, so it's your fault. I would prefer that as an honest answer, which, by the way, is usually the kind of conversations I have with budget gurus when we're speaking informally and off the record.
In fact, that's a lot of what we're hearing now by those who are criticizing Rahm's tax increase, that it seems like it's a big increase, but what they say we really need is, or what the city really needs, is a series of increases.
Well, that's the argument, yeah. And see, I have a hard time making any kind of satisfactory judgment about any of these issues because there's so much deceit in our budget process anyway. I mean, we don't even discuss the TIFs, which is, you know, the ceaseless flow of money from one pot to the other, which grew enormously when Vallis was in charge of the Board of Ed. And Vallis and Chico never said boo about that, where the Board of Ed gave away its right to tax some of the fastest growing real estate in the city of Chicago. As a result, all of our property taxes rose, but it's not an official property tax hike, so they can claim they balanced the budget. So there's so much deceit in how the game is played that you really cannot believe any of your officials when they make these preposterous claims that I didn't raise taxes. Of course you raise taxes. Every year you raise taxes. I don't know how much we need to get to this point. They've seemed to have settled on $500 million. Knowing Rahm, it was probably, they did an internal poll, you know what I mean? And they came, well, the public can handle a $500 million, so let's... That seems like a nice figure, you know. I remember when Daley sold the parking meters, I think they settled on $1 billion because the people would really be impressed with that number of $1 billion. I guess $1 billion doesn't really, you know, mean what it used to mean. But you remember, like, they had Mike Sneed of the Sun-Times trot it out. The city thinks it's going to get $1 billion for the parking meters. And it's like people being like, wow, we're rich, you know.
She's the holder of many trial balloons.
Yeah, that's bad. But the Chicagoans are a funny breed. They're just a happy people, okay? They're easily pleased. I think that Dallas really isn't being fair to his predecessors. The notion that we reformed the system in 1995, only at 20 years later, crying that the system has never been more broken, is in itself a contradiction that the public just can't seem to...
Yeah, what happened to the reform?
Yeah, what happened? Well, that was, by the way, the second reform. That, actually, it was the third. I've now lived through... I moved to Chicago in 81. So there was reform right about the time I got here. There was reform in 89. And there's reform in 95. And now I guess this is the fourth reform.
We need a new euphemism for reform.
Yes, let's deform.
I don't know. Something doesn't sound like
that. Yeah, we have to get rid of reform as a word. I advocated that for a long time.
Well, Ben, that's all we got time for. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you, sir.
Listeners, you know, we always welcome your questions, comments, and suggestions for future interviews. If you use email, you can get those to us via contact@shigov.com. That's C-H-I-G-O-V.com. I'm Dave Glowatz. Thanks for listening.